O God, you created all people in your image. We thank you for the astonishing variety of races and cultures in this world. Enrich our lives by ever-widening circles of fellowship and show us your presence in those who differ most from us, until our knowledge of your love is made perfect in our love for all your children. Through Jesus Christ our Lord. Amen. That's in the Lutheran Book of Worship on page 42. And I think that, you know, sort of distills what this is all about. And I lift it up to you as a place to begin, if you haven't already been involved in it. Another place where you can take action based on where you're at. I have two copies here of this study document, and these are in reserve for the New Lutheran Church. The New Lutheran Church is at a place of work groups where people are saying, this is what I want to see in the new church. And so sometimes when you have a presentation like this, you don't know how to relate it to your own personal life. One of the things that you can do is to get involved in the building of the New Lutheran Church and take some of the things that you're learning up here, hopefully something from my class, and get involved in building the new church. I think it's exciting. Okay. Two books I did request for the bookstore, and they never did come in yet. Or one book. I requested this book, which is American Indians and Christian Missions by Henry Warner Bowden. It's on the recommended list that comes to the congregations out of the National Indian Lutheran Board. And it is a history. It's 1984. And it's a history. It's out of the Chicago History of American Religion. Mr. Bowden is at Rutgers University, and this series will sort of give you an enormous amount of information about the first, from beginning with the first peoples, the Native Indigenous peoples, going back as much as 13,000 documented, archaeological documented cultures experience. It goes back even before then. Describes several of the Indian groups and their earliest contacts and relationships with Christianity. Okay. The first eight tapes that I did that are on in the tape library, which is on the left side as you go down the hall here, are based on this book. And so now I'm starting a second series, and this is much more fun to me, personally, to present this book to you. This book is called Now That the Buffalo's Gone, and it's a study of today's American Indians. And it's written by an Indian. His name is Alvin Josephy. And this will be the sort of core that I'm building the next seven sessions that I have around that. So these again will be on reserve in the reserve library. Okay, this is John, the microphone man. You're on, John, and that tells him to start the tape. I would like to start today with a moment to sort of shift gears. It's a beautiful, warm, sunny afternoon, and I really appreciate your coming out. And I just wonder where your minds have been today, if you were in the peace and justice session or the marriage feast this morning. Maybe some of you just got here and you're just... Anybody been hiking today?
Okay.
So I sort of am calling you to come back and come back in here to this room and kind of shift gears a little bit. It's cool and feels good and... I just want to take a minute to kind of bring you all in here, only to send you out again. Let's stand and turn and face the east.
Which way is that?
Oh, I'm glad you know.
Now this is the first step, you know, in this experience to sense where you are. As you look to the east, you send your mind out that way, you know. Clearly you have a wonderful image in front of your eyes if they're open. You have the village center where we'll gather together while you're here for worship and Vespers. And think about the people here living in Chalet 1 and in this lodge to our left. I think about the four-leggeds, the deer, as you walk down toward the right, there's a mother with triplets down that way. I think about sending you a little further east. The forest, the connection there, that beautiful cathedral of trees that you walk down every time you go down toward the falls or out towards Railroad Creek. Send your spirit down the road again. Think about the people that paddled up and down, the Chelan people, that took maybe 3 days on canoe to go up and down that incredible lake, trading and traveling up and down, carrying goods from the prairie, the plains, the plateau, the Columbia, crossing the pass this time of year and getting things from the coast people, exchanging stories. Send your vision to the east. Think about the two-leggeds that are out there. What about the birds? Send your vision beyond Washington State, Idaho, North Dakota and South Dakota, maybe Minnesota, some of you are from there. Are you connected to the East? A government in Washington, D.C., making decisions that affect your life? Connected to New York? Think of your history. Maybe some of you are connected across the Atlantic or in Canada. Maybe you have a loved one in northern or southern Africa. Maybe you've been to Israel. Send your spirit out to the east. As you go and feel your connectedness, maybe some of you were in Vietnam, or you had someone in Vietnam. Maybe you've been paying attention to China, or even were in China. Maybe some of your nightmares are filled with Russian nuclear bombs, or maybe American nuclear bombs. Because, you know, as you send your spirit to the east, it comes around back across the Pacific, back to us, and we turn to the south. We turn to the south, immediately we see the green, the plants, the trees, the river, the incredible water that gives us life. The mountain. And what is more to the south? For some, it's home, Portland and California. Maybe you have a connection with the people in Central and South America, Antarctica. How easy it is to start sending your spirit to the South. Send a voice. The Andes, Argentina, Brazil, Chile. Across the Antarctic. Where would you come up again? Is it India, Australia? What is your connection to this other side of the world? The people, the two-legged, the mothers and fathers and children that live in this direction. Knowing that your spirit comes back to you. And turn to the west. For some of you, this is home. For some of you, this is the experience of the lake, the past. Seattle, Everett, the Skagit, the Stillaguamish, the Pacific, Japan, and China. Send your spirit and feel your connectedness to all of the living things. Don't go so fast that you forget the waters, the fish, the whales, the salmon. How is your life connected in this direction? What about the children in Russia? What about the young people in Switzerland and Norway and Sweden? And as you go to this direction, your spirit covers again across the United States and you return to yourself. You turn to the north. Send your spirit in this direction to the north. Over Martin Ridge. Out across the great wildernesses that we have, the Pusaitan, the North Cascades. You can just see the vast northern forest that stretches from the Pacific towards your left and all the way across to the Atlantic almost on your right. The great air generating space across the North Pole. And look where you are in Russia. Is it so far? I just think about that jet rushing through. Are we just moments away from them? Aren't we connected? Send your spirit to the north, to your brothers and sisters. And turn to the east. I invite you to look at yourself. Look within. Visualize your whole self. Your health, your physical body, your spirit. Feel your own breathing, your own heart. I invite you to accept the truth that you are a sacred life, that it was a miracle that you were born, that you represent the seventh generation. In fact, you are here because 77 generations before you were here. And you are connected by the life within you and by the life that you pass on to the seventh generation. It's not insignificant that we stand here and we're connected to the 77th generation. And your life is sacred. Invite you to look up. and see where we are in this wonderful spiral of whirling and dancing through space. Imagine the miracle of life that gave us this beautiful planet within that incredible expanse of the stars. Send your spirit across the universe and know that there's something more than humanity. And now, bring your spirit back to this moment and this place. Thank you. I said before, my name is Janice Goodman. I work for the Pacific Northwest Synod of the LCA and the North Pacific District of the ALC. And I work in a ministry to the Lutheran Church, a ministry that has brought me here to share and to experience the abundance here. And I feel so honored because I feel like I have a lot to share. And I know that I've been given so much. What I want to talk about today is titled, I Will Die an Indian. It's titled, I Will Die an Indian, after the first chapter in this book that I've talked about, Now That the Buffalo's Gone. I said that this is the first of seven sessions. And the seven sessions are going to present seven issues that are very important as we who are Lutheran and Indian Lutheran and Indians across the United States experience each other in relationship, learn about each other, care about each other. These things are going to be more and more important in the next 10 years. And the one today is the will of the Indian to endure, to live, to survive as Indians. And just to give you an overview of where you could go, tomorrow will be about the racial stereotypes that are still out there that may be in your mind or in your heart or in my mind and heart as I experience the history of the relationships between Indians and whites. Wednesday is about the spiritual basis of Indian lives and the work that goes on in Indian country to retain our spirituality and to keep our lives on a spiritual foundation. And Thursday, I'll be talking about the tribal land basis, the fight to retain the land. And hopefully we can talk a little bit about the theology of land. And Friday, the reassertion of Indian water rights, an issue that becomes more and more significant to the lives of all people. And then I would have two more next week on fishing and hunting rights, and then the issues of self-determination, sovereignty, and control over tribal affairs and resources. So that's kind of a first spin in a spiral dance around that you might take with me. And you might kind of join it now, and then things happen. Some other day, when you're standing in a bookstore and you see a whole section on Indians, you might pick it up and take another spin. Or you're at your local university and there's a class on Indian studies, you might pick it up and take another spin. But Everything that I say, I would like you to spiral that around through your own inner world, your own personal experience. What does it mean to you to experience? The story of Indians. What does it mean to you when I say, I will die an Indian, is the topic.
When I first saw it on the board, my thought was that it was significant that they felt that an Indian felt inferior, rather than, because I've known where I come from, there's a reservation, there's two reservations within miles of my home, and a lot of the Indians in those two reservations don't really have a lot of self-worth, and you can tell the ones that do by just their monetary value and just how they present themselves, and then there's the others.
It's an interesting point. How many of you are within, say, 200 miles of an Indian reservation? Do you want to say the names real quickly? The tribe?
The Lummi and the Nooksack.
Lummi, Nooksack, is that you?
Muckleshoot.
We have the Coos and Umpqua Indians, just got tribal status.
Where do you live?
Squaxin Island.
Squaxin Island? Squaxin Island Reservation is just across the water from you. This Clocomish and Mud Basin. You live close.
Great.
Yeah. I'm Chicago. Attended the powwow last fall. It's one of the most moving experiences I've had in Montana.
In an urban area, you have an opportunity to experience sometimes over 60 tribes from all over the nation, especially Chicago.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I have the choice. I'll take Warm Springs.
And Warm Springs, Pasco, Paiute, Chehalis. You're close to everybody.
Same.
Yakima.
Paiute, and I think it's Blackfoot
for all. Yeah, so. They have more of an affinity to the Quinaults.
You're the only Indians around me in California are the Maidus.
Say it again.
Maidu. M-A-I-D-U. Oh,
that's new to me.
That's mostly what we have in that particular area. Of course, there are more.
The U.S. Census Bureau says that since 1950, or 1960, it says 552,228 Indians were actually counted by the Census Bureau. In 1980, the count had gone to 1,418,195. I just want to share that as an expression of the vitality of Indian life. And just listen to the diversity too. Indian people participate in the non-Indian society, and there are many in your congregation. Does anybody have Indian people in your own congregation?
We've got a couple. We've got one who's kind of he's married to a white woman, and they've got a couple of children, but they're not real regular members.
Anybody else? When you had a congregation, you had some. Do you get very many on campus?
Yeah, quite a few. There's a United Indians in Higher Education organization. And they're fairly invisible, I would say. There are quite a few Indians on campus.
Almost over 700,000 Indians live on reservations. And this one was new for me, and you probably are not so surprised by this, but I was surprised. The number of young Indians receiving higher education has swelled from a few hundred in a handful of colleges in the early 60s to tens of thousands, including many in graduate schools. Isn't that amazing? Isn't that incredible? Well, just think of the vitality and energy behind that. That may not be as hopeful today as it was even 4 years ago. I leave it to you to meditate on why.
What question? What percentage Indian blood does that count?
One. Well, the Census Bureau uses a quarter. I think. Quarter. I don't remember for sure. But.
For the.
Or do they use self-identification? I think they use self-identification for the U.S. Census.
For the treaty settlement with the Penobscot and Padmaswati, the state of Maine, it's one quarter is their criteria.
Yeah.
My father is included in that.
Indian people are just everywhere. In industry, science, law, medicine, communications, technology, education, art, literature, finance, with national and international scope of influence. It's real exciting. It's one of the things that I have to say when I say I will die an Indian. When I have to say that, when I lift that up, many of you have been taught that Indians are vanishing people, that they're on their way out. I know when I was a child, I heard that lots of times. And I'm here to say it isn't true. It's very active, vital, viable part. It's not something that's going to disappear and go away, the existence of Indian people in our country. And as we get into this book, you'll understand that the fact of their lives and the fact of their existence and the reality of Indian history is going to impact, continues to impact all of American life.
Isn't this happening generally with the whole old concept of the melting pot is no longer out.
It's a very freeing idea to just let go of that old concept of the melting pot.
Ethnic and cultural groups are reasserting their own identity and culture and tradition.
Right. It's a tremendous burst of pride and nationalism and identity in Indian country. It's very exciting. And I say freeing because it allows each of us to go back into who we are. And again, it's that, what I said, the spiral dance. Take that and let it be a free gift to you to figure out, you know, that it's okay to be whatever it is that is your history. Indians are assertive and active, and that's not always been clearly understood. And I think this is a very helpful book. The only thing is that I also hear, as a Christian, an overtone of anger in this book, an overtone of we were talking in conversation on teaching staff about a concept of gentle justice. I think Josephy is a clear voice for justice, but he may not be as gentle as I would. You know, I actually hesitated to sort of say, take this and read this, without saying, take it and read it, and understand that anger, as you read it, you understand, is often very much justified. And a Christian challenge to do justice in a gentle way.
So it's out of frustration.
I think it's very productive, but it's also threatening it in some ways that it's expressed, I think. Well, I hear a little of that, and maybe you'll agree with me when you hear it. Okay. The point that I want to make that you can get is that over five centuries, since the earliest interactions of Indians and non-Indians, there has been an incredible history. How many of you have read Bury My Heart at Wounded Knee?
I read it.
How many of you feel that you know the history of the interaction between Indians and non-Indians? Have you had experience with the cycle of sort of contact and sharing, degenerating to conflict and competition? Degenerating to policies of warfare or removal or takeover. to treaty making and reservation making. Have you sort of heard that cycle before? This is a history. In the first chapter of this book, takes a case study approach and tells the history of a particular group. How many of you feel that there are, what is your sense about Indians in Florida? Anybody have any sense that they want to share about? Are there Indians in Florida? Who are the Indians in Florida, if there are any?
Seminole.
Well, the first chapter of this book, and I have confessed to a real cowardice in being the one to deliver the stories of destruction and killing that you can hear if you follow the history of one Indian tribe. This other one is just full of plenty of good information, and I've covered that quite a bit in telling some of the stories of the Pueblos, the eradication, virtual eradication of the Huron, the incredible destructiveness between the Puritans and the Massachusetts and the history of the Delaware people. It's not fun. It's not happy. It's not a good... it's just not a happy history. Some have called it a shameful legacy. It's something that we all have inherited, a history. And the first chapter in this book takes that step to end any sort of denial that the reader might be into as far as what is the truth about this land. How does it come to be in our hands? What might be of value to you if you were to accept the reality that the land in America came to your hands at the pain of the native indigenous peoples? What if we just put that out on the table and said, this is the truth, that the land that you own came in a painful way at the cost of many, many lives, at the destruction of whole cultures? Is there any value in owning that darkness? Scott here, if you want to pick up some of his tapes from last week, has been teaching us to befriend the evil, not only within ourselves, but within our own American history. I mean, it's not hard for me to sit here and say it's pretty good for me, maybe, to be able to say the history is shameful. But what good would it do you? Anybody?
To recognize what happened is the first step in repentance and forgiveness and reconciliation. And my experience with Native peoples is pretty limited. The few experiences I've had with them, so therefore I'm more ready to forgive than we would ever expect. And it just amazes me.
Is there much to do? So you're ready in by laying that on the table and saying, this is the truth. The land was taken. You're ready to take a step toward forgiveness and healing.
I'm saying that needs to be done for that to occur.
Yeah. Do you ever get a feeling that you're not responsible? Personally, that it's something that happened, you know, like generations back, that you didn't personally do this. Anybody feel like that?
I feel that, in a way, I can look at our own community and I can say a lot of it is our responsibility, because for years, these people were treated as second-class citizens. They were to be seen and not heard within, you know, when they came off the reservation. There's still, awful jokes that go around. And, I just can't, and I've seen people I went to school with brilliant minds. And a lot of, there's one, he's a hopeless drug addict and he's been crippled in an accident. His life has just turned from a very positive person to somebody who probably won't make it past the age of 35 years old. And, and it's sad to see that, because he was somebody I grew up around and he's a friend of mine as we grew up in our early years.
So if we put that on the table too.
Yeah, that, a lot of it was just the fact that we have not been able to accept, we've just said, well, they're nothing but a bunch of drunks out there anyway, they're hopeless people, they add nothing of worth to our community. And that's been, in the area of Washington that I live in, that's been pretty much a fact throughout the whole county.
So if we put on the table that it is a reality, that part of this process has been a sort of a community degradation of a people's, if it's out there, what does that do for you? Is it good for you to be able to say that this is part of our history? How can we redeem that and make that a good thing for us?
I think what you were saying earlier about connectedness in terms of this particular time frame with other places also works back and forth in time. And I think that's where we maybe lose the sense that we are connected in that way. My mother, people grew up around Cascade, Montana, Flathead country. And you talk about the jokes that come out of the community. The joke in our family was that my uncles always said, they had to convince everyone in Cascade, Montana, that they were not Canadian American, they were not tribal American members. Until oil was found on the reservation, and they wished they had not convinced everyone so well. And that is, I think, as much a problem as it was to literally go out and shoot someone and run them out of tribal areas or to put them on reservations or whatever it's their attitude. That connectedness with that attitude that needs to be broken and resolved.
So maybe if we end the denial of the history between Indians and whites, then we're free to talk about things like guilt and reconciliation. And we can move to positive steps, maybe making personal relationships with real Indian people, and able to sort of get discernment that real Indian people are people like Janice and Ira Frank, if some of you have met him. And they're real people, and they live all around us, and they're trying to survive. And then we can learn the history and learn about each other. We can become advocates for Indian people. And we can, in sensing our connectedness to our history with Indians, also have some connectedness and understanding with other Native Indigenous peoples all over the world who are also going through processes. How many of you have an interest in the situation in Southern Africa with apartheid? You can't study apartheid and the reservations and the processes without thinking about the history of American Indians. There's a connectedness. Anybody interested in Central and South America? And the connectedness between the history and why things are the way they are in Central and South America. Go back to the history of how they got to be this way in the United States. Go back to the theology and the philosophies of the earliest peoples who came. to understand the connectedness. I only have just a few more minutes, and I want to read you a quote from a traditional Seminole that may give you something to think about. This was said to the President of the United States in 1954. We do not say that we are superior or inferior to the white man, and we do not say that the white man is superior or inferior to us. We do say that we are not white men, but Indians. And we do not wish to become white men, but we wish to remain Indians and have an outlook on all things different from the outlook of the white man. We do not wish to own lands because our land is for all of us. We live on our land, which is the land of all our tribe, and we live from our land, which is the land of all our tribe. And we have failed to have your Indian agent or your Secretary of Interior or your other government officials understand our outlook. Throughout this country, the people, the native indigenous people, the Tiguas, the Powhatans, the Wishrams, the Haumas, the Mandans, the Croatians, the Alabamas, the Yukis, the Quapas, the Wampanoags, the Wailakis, people who are all declared extinct, are alive. The native peoples are alive, and they want to be alive, and they will be alive.